This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Boonman. Heavy shelling hit the capital of Ethiopia's Tigray region Saturday, and the city braced for an all-out offensive by government forces against its dissident leaders. The local government said that Ethiopia's military has started hitting with heavy weaponry and artillery the center of Mekelle. Two humanitarian officials with staff in the city confirmed the strikes. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, winner of last year's Nobel Peace Prize, announced November 4th that he had ordered military operations against Tigray's ruling party, the TPLF. More than 3 weeks of fierce fighting has left thousands dead. The prime minister announced Thursday he had ordered a final offensive, and Ethiopia's military says it has circled the regional capital, but a communications blackout has made it difficult to verify claims from both sides. Abiy has repeatedly brushed off international calls for a halt to fighting and negotiations with TPLF leaders, saying they need to be disarmed and apprehended. Sudan needs $150 million in aid to cope with the flood of Ethiopian refugees crossing the border from the conflict zone, the UN Refugee Agency chief said Saturday during a visit to a camp. He said the funds are needed for water, shelter, and health services. Sudan has accepted more than 43,000 Ethiopian refugees while struggling with its own deep economic crisis. The country is also going through a fragile transition since the April 2019 ouster of veteran strongman Omar al-Bashir after unprecedented mass protests against his rule triggered by economic hardship. Some 65% of Sudan's nearly 42 million people live below the poverty line, according to government figures. This is VOA News. Britain is set to approve a COVID-19 vaccine developed by BioNTech and Pfizer next week, and deliveries would begin within hours of the authorization, the Financial Times is reporting on Saturday. And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has named Nadhim Zahawi, currently a junior business minister, as the minister responsible for COVID-19 vaccine deployment. Coronavirus deaths, meanwhile, topped 400,000 Saturday in Europe, the world's second worst hit region, as parts of the continent began to reopen shops for the holiday season. But across the Atlantic, fearful U.S. shoppers turned to online outlets for a massive Black Friday sale, while densely populated Los Angeles County announced a ban on gatherings of people from different households under a new safer-at-home order to battle the surging pandemic. Of the new deaths on Saturday, Britain accounted for almost two-thirds of the fatalities at over 57,500, followed by Italy with over 53,600, France at over 51,900, and Spain with over 44,600 deaths. Germany, once a beacon of hope in Europe's coronavirus nightmare, logged more than 1 million cases on Friday. Although the virus spread is slowing thanks to weeks of tough restrictions, Europe remains at the heart of the pandemic, recording more cases than the United States in the past week. The United States surpassed 13 million total cases on Friday, the world's highest figure, and officials were concerned whether gatherings on Thursday for the Thanksgiving holiday would worsen the situation. The virus clouded the traditional Black Friday shopping day for retail stores, but Americans are estimated to have spent $10 billion online, tech company Adobe said, based on its analytics. Further north in Canada, whose largest city, Toronto, is under lockdown, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced that a general who led NATO's mission in Iraq, as well as Canadian troops in Afghanistan and Bosnia, would spearhead a gigantic vaccination drive. Trudeau said it would be the biggest immunization in the history of his country. The pandemic is spreading fastest in Asia and Latin America and is up by 113% over the week in Mexico. Globally, more than 1.4 million deaths have been recorded and 61 million infections, although the real numbers are unknown because testing and reporting methods vary. The rollout of the first vaccines is expected next month. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Taking testimony, collecting evidence while the crimes or just after the crimes are being committed is essential to understand what happened and then to also try to hold people accountable through some kind of prosecution at the end of all of this.
African Union envoys meet Ethiopian Prime Minister as a measure to end the conflict in the Horn of Africa.
Opening up a communication, but also thorough, independent international investigations into events which have happened to ensure that further down the line, those who are responsible for what we believe could be a series of very serious abuses will be held to account.
Human Rights Watch is trying to investigate a series of allegations of airstrikes on civilian infrastructure, as well as reports of mass killings in Ethiopia.
To insinuate that there are other forces and it's that could have participated in this. But in Uganda, it's clearly known that the only guns known, you know, to be in such spaces are by army and the police, and they are different other sisters like the LDU and the ISO and whatever.
And the Uganda police investigate their violent crackdown that left at least 45 protesters dead. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. From the African Union met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in the capital Addis Ababa Friday. The meeting officials say forms part of the continental body's effort to help resolve the ongoing conflict in the Horn of Africa. The AU representatives include former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, former South African President Halima Motlanthe, and the former Mozambican President Joaquim Chissano. They were seeking to mediate between the government in Addis Ababa and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. This following 3 weeks of conflict between the two sides. For analysis of the latest development about the conflict, I reach Cameron Hudson, Senior Fellow at the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council.
Well, I don't think it's a surprise that they came away empty-handed and were essentially rebuffed by the Prime Minister. He seems to have been very clear in his belief that there is a military solution to the political problem that he faces. And I'm not surprised that that his position didn't change.
Do you anticipate a possible ceasefire between the two warring sides, particularly with the stance taken by the Prime Minister?
No, I don't. I don't anticipate any kind of ceasefire right now. I think that a ceasefire will only come once there's an exhausted force on both sides. And my fear is that the human cost of achieving a ceasefire will be incredibly high, both from a casualty perspective and from a refugee perspective. I don't believe that the Prime Minister right now is in any mood to negotiate, mediate, or to lay down arms to seek a political solution.
Do you think efforts by the international community, including the European Union, to have a negotiated solution to the ongoing conflict will help in resolving some of these challenges, including the humanitarian crisis unfolding?
What I think is about to happen is you're going to see a lot more pressure mounted on the Prime Minister. I think that Europeans and U.S. Diplomats were waiting to give the AU a chance. They were allowing the African Union to lead in the effort to get a mediation process started. And so they were waiting on the sidelines. But I know that they are preparing now to mount their own pressure campaign that could include, obviously, personal outreach to the Prime Minister, but also, I think, the threat of sanctions or other arms embargoes and the like. I know that there's a whole host of things that are being considered by Western powers to try to put pressure on the prime minister to relent in this campaign of retaking Mekelle and to bring him to the negotiating table with the TPLF. So I think in the days ahead, you're going to see even more pressure, concerted pressure coming from the West to try to avoid a worst case scenario.
Do you see any end in sight at the moment?
You know, unfortunately, I don't right now, even though it would seem that the Ethiopian military has been pretty decisive in reclaiming areas of Tigray. That's, first of all, not verifiable at this point. So the claims of the ENDF that they are holding these towns and territory, we just can't ascertain that at the moment. But I also think that even if there is a bloody battle for Mekelle, and even if the TLF is pushed back and pushed out, I think the fear that many people have is that they will go into a kind of insurgency and that the fighting will continue, but it will continue around the country. It will continue in targeting soft targets, political targets. And so the prime minister will be faced with a long, drawn out war that will eventually, I think, if it gets to that point, really have a huge devastating effect on the civilians in the country. And only then, I think, will pressure be sufficient for the prime minister to seek a negotiated settlement. But right now, he is completely convinced that there is a military solution to this political problem.
Cameron, I've heard people call for international investigation into what they say is a gross humanitarian abuses or violation of rights of individuals, at the ongoing conflict. Do you think that is reasonable?
Absolutely. I mean, it's reasonable right now because the prime minister isn't allowing any media, isn't allowing any human rights investigators, except those that will tell the story that he wants to tell. So there have been some very well documented cases of atrocities committed by the TPLF, but the rest of Tigray is completely in the dark. And so we need an investigation, not just of government abuses, but of the TPLF abuses. So there needs to be full accountability for the crimes that are being committed in this context. I think a first step right now would be to have investigation teams on the Sudanese side of the border, interviewing refugees as they come across, while the experiences are still fresh in their minds, so that we can understand the patterns of violence, the patterns of conflict that are going on in Tigray. And then, of course, when there's an environment where it's safe to be on the ground, international investigators should also be there. I think that, it's perhaps premature to talk about an accountability process, but we know from other processes in mass atrocity situations, whether it's in Myanmar or Syria or the like, that taking testimony, collecting evidence while the crimes or just after the crimes are being committed is essential to understand what happened, and then to also try to hold people accountable through some kind of prosecution at the end of all of this.
Cameron Hudson is Senior Fellow at the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Still in Ethiopia, Human Rights Watch says it is trying to investigate a series of allegations of airstrikes on civilian infrastructure, as well as reports of mass killings. The inquiry follows the ongoing conflict, which has forced tens of thousands to flee their homes into neighboring countries. The rights group is also calling on both sides of the conflict to allow humanitarian organizations unfettered access to provide much-needed help to those caught in the conflict. This following a meeting between Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and a peace delegation from the African Union Friday. To learn more about the call for unhindered access to humanitarian organizations, as well as an inquiry into human rights abuses, I reached Letitia Bader, the Horn of Africa Director at Human Rights Watch.
Humanitarian organizations have increasingly been sounding the alarm bell about what could be an absolute humanitarian disaster in the Tigray region, given that they still do not have access to the region. The roads and airspace have been closed off. Now, yesterday, the Office of the Prime Minister in Ethiopia put out a statement suggesting that there might be some opening, although there is absolutely no clarity at this point if that would be for international humanitarian assistance, if it would only be to areas where the government is in theory controlling. What we're calling for is unhindered access for international humanitarian organizations throughout the region.
What is the current situation about the humanitarian crisis?
Oh, it's very difficult to know right now because there is still a communications shutdown. So both telephone and internet are off in the TK region. So for humanitarian organizations, I mean, there are multiple concerns with the communication shutdown. It impedes independent media reporting. It makes it very difficult for organizations like ours to be able to really understand what's going on the ground. But it also makes it very difficult for humanitarian organizations to be able to assess the needs and understand at what level their supplies are at in the region. So, you know, what we do know is that there are 43,000 people from the Tigray region who have now fled into Sudan, who are arriving in really terrible conditions, according to humanitarian actors on the ground inside Sudan. So in some ways, a little snapshot of what might be happening in the Tigray region is now becoming much clearer inside Sudan, where there is also very little for the moment humanitarian assistance available. It's a very distant part of the country to access, etc. So humanitarian organizations are trying to scale up there at the moment. I mean, we as an organization are trying to investigate a series of allegations, both of potential airstrikes on civilian infrastructure, but also following up on very alarming reports of mass killings in Western Tigray in the early phases of the conflict. But all this is incredibly difficult to really look into and document in the way we would need to really be able to determine what we're talking about, these violations of international humanitarian law or not, without having information from people who are on the ground, from witnesses, etc. And at the moment, that we just do not have access to them.
How difficult is your investigation? Because some people have expressed concern that there could be gross human rights violations going on currently. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, what information has come out so far, one of the exceptions has generally been because of people leaving the region. So either because of people being brought into the Amhara region. So the incident which has received now a lot of attention has been a mass killings of civilians in the town of Maïkadra. And what appears very clear is that even though it is still very difficult to know the context in which these killings took place, that there were many men, particularly of ethnic Amhara descent, who were killed on November the 9th. But a lot of that information has come out either because of people being brought outside into the Amhara region to receive medical treatment, or also more recently because the National Ethiopian Human Rights Commission was granted access to Maïkadra specifically. For the moment, the only other insights which are available into what other abuses may have happened against civilians are from those who are fleeing into Sudan. But as you can imagine at the moment, I mean, it is still very limited reporting. People are arriving every day. So it is still much too early to have a clear picture of events. And this is why we are calling on the international community, on regional partners, to really make sure that as part of any discussions right now with the Ethiopian authorities and both parties to the conflict, it is absolutely key to be pushing for an international independent investigation to look into events which have been happening in recent weeks.
Some Ethiopians and Tigrayans that I spoke with are calling on the international community to act decisively to push both sides of the conflict for a negotiated settlement to help resolve some of these humanitarian crises that are unfolding. What is a human rights position on ending the conflict?
Well, I mean, we are calling both for immediate humanitarian access so that the immediate needs of people and civilians inside the Tigray region can be met. We're also talking and calling on all actors, both trying to engage with the parties to the conflict, although there has still not been much movement on that front, to really make sure that messaging around humanitarian access, but also around the need for independent monitoring, opening up of communications, but also thorough independent international investigations into events which have happened to ensure that further down the line, those who are responsible for what we believe could be a series of very serious abuses will be held to account.
Letitia Beda is the Horn of Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. She spoke with me from the Italian capital, Rome. The Ugandan police have launched an inquiry into violence that led to the death of at least 45 protesters. Their deaths are blamed on excessive force used by the police. Critics say the police inquiry appears to be a mere public relations exercise. A serious and independent inquiry, they argue, would identify the officers who are responsible for the death and would ensure those found responsible face the full force of the law. Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, is a leading member of the Ugandan Women's Protesting Working Group, a human rights organization. She tells me that international pressure should ensure those behind the deaths of the unarmed protesters are punished to serve as a deterrent to other errant police or security forces.
At one point, we petitioned the police and we were written to that under the Police Standards Unit in Uganda, the PSU, would be investigating the allegations we had or the complaints we had. Up to date, we have not heard from them. So if they say they will investigate this, maybe they will now that there is a bigger pressure. There is now that the things they did called for even the international community to comment, to intervene, to speak it down, and to the point that even donors, people that are partners of Uganda in the various disciplines, have also spoken about this. The religious leaders are speaking about this. And given the magnitude of what happened last week, we do hope that indeed they investigate this.
Some people are saying that the police, investigating the police, will not amount to anything. They want an independent investigation to really find out what really happened and the perpetrators involved. What is your take on that?
Indeed, also as a human rights defender, I would think that this is what would work. If we would have completely independent bodies investigate these things, and then if the Human Rights Commission, which we visited in the past 24 hours, tasking them to bring out the names and clear number of the dead people. The people that died, you say, are 45, but we know that from a reliable circles, this number could be now at around 56. Some people are missing. Many people are in prisons unknown. Many have been released, but many are still missing. I think that police investigating the police indeed might be a bit impossible. It might be, I mean, the usual. Speaking to you as a victim of police brutality last year, I endured police brutality to a tune that I lost my uterus. I lost my womb. I can not ever have a child biologically because I was brutalized and tortured by Uganda police right in front of the headquarters. So looking at the fact that I have never found justice even when I tried to reach the court, if all of these concerns have never been met with any justice, even to an individual person like I do not know how police really can assure us they are investigating their own.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps the police investigating itself would have the opportunity to correct some of the mistakes they carried out during the recent protests in order to amend their ways to be effective in de-escalating situations when there's a confrontation with the unarmed citizens who are on a protest and all that. What do you say to that?
What I can say to that is indeed that's the suspicion we would have as Ugandans. That's the suspicion we have as victims. We do not see people that committed crimes against humanity, crimes against Ugandans, come out and correct and say what was and hold themselves accountable. It's quite impossible. And for me, I would think that we demand that the UN and other bigger bodies, even maybe international ICC, Hague, and maybe the African Union, the East African community, if we can have independent bodies involved, but we cannot trust in police investigating police.
Some Ugandans are calling for the police officers who carried out the violence leading to the death of at least 45 protesters should be singled out and punished or prosecuted to the full force of the law. Others are saying this is a learning opportunity and that it might not happen because it was sanctioned by the powers that be. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts about this, you see, when all this violence happened, unluckily or maybe luckily now, because I witnessed the biggest part of it, I was in the city center. In the city center, I saw people that were not even wearing uniform, people that did not have a name tag, hold guns and point them into shopping arcades and open fire. I saw people that were in civilian clothes, carry guns and shoot at people. But these people often jumped off green trucks of the military. These people jumped off blue trucks of the police. So making it currently, we've had the police try to defend themselves by saying they are not even sure all the chaos was done by the forces. Why? Because for us, we see that they are trying to insinuate that there are other forces. And it's that could have participated in this. But in Uganda, it's clearly known that the only guns known, you know, to be in such spaces are by army and the police, and they have different other sisters like the LDU and the ISO and whatever.
Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, is a leading member of the Ugandan Women's Protest Working Group, a human rights organization. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Healthcare workers treating COVID-19 patients say their work is taking a toll on their mental state, forcing some into depression and therapy. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
John Moishohio is one of thousands of Kenyan medical workers treating COVID-19 patients. With the stress of the pandemic already on him, in late July, he also tested positive for the virus.
As a human being also, I'm also thinking aloud that I'm positive for COVID. What will happen next? What if death comes? And it's not easy. It is really a traumatizing state, and especially being out there. You cannot tell people because you don't know how people will take it.
Moishohio is one or more than 700 Kenyan medical workers to test positive for COVID-19. A trained psychologist, he was so upset by the diagnosis, he had to seek counseling himself. He wasn't alone. On an August weekend, 50 medical workers from Tigoni Hospital Treatment Center attended mental wellness counseling sessions.
We have been going through a lot. The schedules have changed. We have been very busy, and so having a day off where you're having fun, forgetting there's COVID, it was very, 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 very rejuvenating.
I feel a bit lighter. I feel like I'm very relieved. I feel like I have now gained the strength to continue with my daily duties.
Like their colleagues worldwide, Kenyan medical workers have been working long hours to attend to patients infected with the virus.
A lot of those small trauma end up piling up, and it can be really psychologically distressing. So we decided that we will come here and have a day of expressive therapy, debriefing, art therapy, bonding, and having fun and games. You know, it was a day to make the health workers feel like they are loved and appreciated.
With the pandemic ongoing, it is a day that these medical workers certainly needed. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Food Programme says hundreds of thousands of people in southern Madagascar are in the grips of a hunger emergency brought on by consecutive years of drought and ruined harvest. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
3 years of consecutive drought have wiped out Madagascar's harvests and driven desperately hungry people to fall back on extreme measures to put food on their tables. The World Food Programme says hunger has spread across 10 districts in southern Madagascar. It says 1.5 million people, or half the region's population, are struggling to feed themselves. It says women and children are most affected and in need of immediate food and nutrition assistance. WFP spokesman Thompson Fury says Madagascar has the world's highest stunting rate, a condition that impairs a child's growth and physical and mental development. He says nearly half of children under the age of 5 suffer from chronic malnutrition.
As hunger numbers rise, so does the proportion of families who are resorting to crisis coping mechanisms. The majority of them are having to eat bugs. They are selling off life-saving livelihoods, assets, farm implements, kitchen utensils.
An assessment in the southern district of Amboasiri finds 3/4 of children have dropped out of school so they could help their parents forage for food. The WFP has been providing emergency food aid for 100,000 people in the hard-hit area since the end of September. It also is helping more than 500,000 people in 9 other drought-stricken districts through December. Given the gravity of the hunger crisis, the WFP is scaling up its humanitarian operation to assist nearly 900,000 of the most vulnerable people through June. It is appealing for international support, noting $37.5 million is needed to implement its humanitarian operation over the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
November marks 3 years since Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa took power from the late Robert Mugabe and promised to honor his people's constitutional right. But critics say freedom of the press is not being respected, pointing to the 2 arrests this year of journalist Hopeful Chinono. For VOA, Colombo's Mavunga spoke with Chinono and has this report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
That is reporter Hopo Chinono exchanging words with prosecutors after his second arrest this year, both triggered by messages on Twitter. The first arrest in late July was for a tweet supporting an anti-corruption protest. The second in November followed a tweet criticizing Zimbabwe's Chief Justice. He is now facing charges of inciting unrest and obstruction of justice, as well as demeaning the country's National Prosecution Authority. Chinono says authorities are sending a clear message with his arrests, and Zimbabwe's journalists are listening.
And because of those arrests, consequently, journalists are afraid of pushing the envelope and doing the right thing, practicing journalism, because they are saying to themselves, if they could arrest Hopeful twice for practicing journalism, what more could happen to us? We are not as prominent as he is, and we could just languish and rot in the prisons.
Former President Robert Mugabe often used restrictive media laws to arrest critical journalists during his 37-year rule. When President Emmerson Mnangagwa came to power in 2017, he promised free expression, raising hopes of change among journalists and citizens. Authorities have maintained that Chinono's arrests were about upholding the law, not cracking down on press freedoms. Ndabaningi Mangwana is the secretary for Zimbabwe's Ministry of Information.
Nobody has been arrested under any law which has something to do with the media. But if laws have been broken in other sections of our security, obviously, whether it's a journalist, a lawyer, or a doctor, people will be arrested. But other than that, the environment for the media to operate has been very enabling.
The Information Ministry official noted that 6 new television stations were just licensed in Zimbabwe and added that foreign media houses were now free to operate in the country. But press freedom groups say the Zimbabwean government has never stopped efforts to muzzle the media. This is Tabani Moyo, head of the Media Institute of Southern Africa in Zimbabwe.
One step forward, 10 backwards. Cracks on investigative journalism, case of Hopo Chingono. The attacks on the industry have been aggressive, and we have seen the weaponizing of the law, the introduction of the cybersecurity bill, which seeks to snoop and empower the military to crack down on expression. The heavy-handedness of the regime on the media has been highly pronounced.
If the cybercrime bill becomes law, Zimbabweans accused of spreading falsehoods on social media could be punished with up to 5 years in prison. Chingono is expected to go to trial next month for allegedly inciting the protests against corruption in July this year. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Inspirational youths in Malawi have designed solutions to help their communities confront COVID-19 challenges. This is thanks to COVID-19 Youth Innovation Challenge UNICEF organized in June, the peak of the COVID-19 infection in Malawi for youths aged 14 to 35. The aim was to make young people change agents in their communities by offering solutions to challenges caused by COVID-19. 5 finalists out of 1,717 participants have emerged winners. Among them is a 23-year-old Sam Masikini, who has developed an application known as Inspire, which would help learners in rural areas with poor or no internet connection access learning resources on their phones offline. For VOA, reporter Lamek Masina talked with Sam Masikini about his innovation and the progress so far.
My innovation is centered around providing inclusive education to the rural area of Malawi. So we're talking about the number of youth in rural areas that get to access relevant or quality education resources and tools for their learning. To narrow it down, we're talking about an offline learning application on pretty much a basic mobile phone for these students.
What forced you exactly to come up with such an innovation?
Well, in the first place, joining the challenge, we're solving problems based on personas or characters. And I remember my character very well. Her name was Nomvelo. Her description was like, she's a student in the village. And since the coming in of COVID-19, she's no longer going to school and she would like to continue learning. And that's how it all started. And that's how I got it picked up. So that's where the whole idea was generated, and I was solving for this persona. And then I discovered and I realized that, wow, there's a huge number of students in this category, especially in Malawi. And I was like, this is the way to go.
Quite interesting development. But is it a one-man show, or there are other partners who are giving you a hand?
This is not a one-man working. It's a whole lot of people behind. There's MHub, there's Mzuzu Hub, there's Zuka, the Sigo Family Foundation, and so many people that I'm really grateful for. People that are driving, are the driving force of change, most specifically in our country, and people that are always there to help out in situations like this.
How will this innovation help to solve the problem of lack of internet connectivity which learners face in rural Malawi?
Thank you for that. So the application is designed to give access to educational resources. And what we'll do is, or what is going to happen is that we'll have the Malawi schools curriculum for the secondary section on the application. So this application sits on the phone or in the phone with all this content. And how do we get to the students or the youth of Malawi is we're going to use the secondary schools at which they are. and will provide these devices together with the application that has the content inside to the students via their schools. In this way, the student can access their educational resources and supplement their learning. That is, if they're going back to school and practicing some policies for the COVID-19, the precautionary measures, or they can do something in wait to learn or to reopen their schools. So in that case, they will have all visual content. So we're talking of the video and audio content as well as a few textual content.
And how many learners have you targeted? And how will this application be distributed to the learners?
For the record, UNICEF estimates 1.3 million school dropouts. And what we're looking at here, we have about 2.7 million secondary school students. And that is just a combination of both the rural and the urban areas. But be reminded that there is a whole lot of the youthful population based in the rural areas. And a large number of these 2.7 million students are, in fact, in the rural areas. And how is this going to be delivered is we'll use the school facilities where these students are based to meet a large number of these students, because there's already a network of them at their school. So we can have that, and then on a different program is we can target others that were not going to school as well through their community leaders in different villages.
So now what is the progress so far?
Progress has been really good. We've had our first test in a few system requirements or functionalities. As we're speaking right now, we'll have the test next week. We're supposed to have them this week, but if we're not having them Saturday, we'll have them next week Saturday. And after that, we'll have a few tests with teachers just to get their input as well, because we believe this to be something inclusive and we can't do it without involving the end users or our targeted users in the designing and development process.
And after the testing, what next?
The next step will be to digitize the content, and with a partnership with Padziwe, we'll be able to roll out, just for a beginning part, to roll out a few modules into the system to get the fully fledged test before we actually roll it out to the public.
How soon are you planning to roll out this project?
Yes, we're given about 3 months, and per project planning, this is what we're working towards to. So we're expecting to have something really functional and usable early December, somewhere there, before even heading into the next year.
Sam Masekene is the young innovator in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. He was talking with reporter Lamek Masina. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Achana na manyambafu kwa siku pande kichwani. Midomo yao michafu usiku nyime amani. Wenipende kama sarafu unifiche kwa pani. Na unigande siafu hata tukiwa njiani. Nafasi wafukunyu watakutia aibu za ukubwa bwaja kama kasuku kujifanya wataratibu hawana lolote mazumbuku wana maswahibu waongo hata mwezi mtukufu tusilete mbele kisambu kwa nyama wataona kisambu.
Oh, yeah.
come make me change and follow you. If you tell me, when you look at me, look at me, see
anytime when I miss you, girl, I'm gonna ask where you go.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sale, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a lean child cannot be fattened in just one day. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.